Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is a member of Sweden's oldest existing noble family. A journalist, his debut novel, entitled 1793 in Swedish and The Wolf and the Watchman in English, was named Best Debut of 2017 by the Swedish Academy of Crime Writers. It's been a huge hit domestically, and it's now been sold to over 30 other territories. Nicholas Nachtokdach, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Oh, well done there. Thank you very much.
Tell us what that name means.
Well, it means night and day. The origin is we have a family crest that's a shield that's split in gold and blue, and the names originated from that. It became night and day.
And it's a very, very old and noble family.
It's from 1280, I think. Yeah. But we've been destitute for the last 300 years or so.
As is the way with so many of the gentry. Yeah. Did English literature have a big part to play in your childhood?
Yes, certainly. I was quite a lonely child. The reading became sort of my salvation. I turned to books and suddenly you would have company all the time. And you find yourself in quite an intimate relationship with men and women who have written books, who may be long dead and who you have nothing else in common with. But the words they've written come alive in your head, and it's wonderful. So from that day, I always thought, wow, an author is the finest thing you can hope to be. It's a company to those who have none. And I've never wanted to be anything else, but it took me a long time.
And I know that the work of Patrick O'Brien was important to you and actually quite a formative experience.
It was indeed. I was in San Francisco when I was quite young with my mother visiting friends of the family, and there was to be a barbecue night. I was maybe 10. I was loafing about on a couch reading a book, as I would usually do, and the guy in charge of this barbecue, who was this Clint Eastwood-looking, really man's man, self-made millionaire kind of American, very intimidating, he came to me and said, I would like you to clean the barbecue grate for tonight, which I did not want to do. So I did a really sloppy job of it. And he called me on it and said, no, you didn't do a good job. You should, do you want another chance? Because this is not up to scratch. My only sort of vengeance that I could take was, I thought to myself, I'll clean this grate to a mirror sheen. You'll never have seen it. It looked better than you. So I did that in rage. And he was happy. And the day after he came back, because obviously he noticed that I read a lot. And he gave me the first two books of Patrick O'Brien's Aubrey Maturin cycle, which was Master and Commander and Post Captain. He was a sailor himself, and he said, this is for you, you did a good job, and here's your reward. And he taught me a valuable lesson, that if you put your mind to it and do a good job, good things may come of it. And he also said, you can give the first ones to your worst enemy or your best friend, because they will never stop reading them. And that was indeed the case. So it took me many years, but I eventually finished the whole 20. I haven't read the unfinished last one, I must admit. But Patrick O'Brien was great, and as historical fiction goes, it sort of taught me how much you will forgive an author if the characters wins your heart. Because there are so many naval battles described in exquisite detail, and the naval terms of the time. He doesn't care one bit that you don't know what he's talking about. And, I mean, there are two or three of these in every book, and I read every one sitting on nails, never ever picturing in my mind where these ships are in relation to one another, but I just want to know what happens, and it works, and it's so great.
And Umberto Eco, as well as Alan Moore, were big influences in your whole literary development, which took a long, long time, but as we know, resulted in the biggest hit novel in Sweden this year.
Yeah, Umberto Eco, I read The Name of the Rose when I was quite young. Probably, I would say, I even saw the movie first and then got sort of turned on to the book. And I thought it was excellent. And at that time, I found it to be a thrilling story about serial killings in a medieval monastery, kind of action-packed even. And then several years later, I reread that book. And at that point, I had sort of found access to a whole different level of things going on in that novel, where there's a whole, I mean, Umberto Eco was a scholar with the sort of medieval mind as his focus, and he's really telling you a convoluted history lesson about the doctrine of the Catholic Church and the position of laughter and comedy and humor. I thought that was great, and I was amazed that that book works on all levels. I mean, if you're not interested in the supposed existence of Aristotle's sequel to tragedy, comedy, you don't have to worry about it because the book is great anyway. But if you are, it enhances the experience.
Yeah, a little bit like From Hell, which is, of course, by Alan Moore, which if you're not interested in Jack the Ripper, which is essentially what it's about, there are many other things to appreciate about that. And the fantastic graphics by Eddie Campbell.
Yeah, Alan Moore is probably the best writer I know of in any medium. I think he is a genius. And I read an interview with him talking about From Hell in particular, where he said that his starting point was actually a novel by Douglas Adams called Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, where the premise is that Dirk Gently has to solve a crime holistically. So he has to solve the society in which the crime was committed. And that is the starting point from Hell, because Alan Moore takes that and he describes as much of, in many cases, very horrible Victorian society and shows us how those murders were a natural consequence of things going on.
Which is really where we come to your book, The Wolf and the Watchman. Now, it had been percolating in your head for a very long time.
Yes, and the reason for that, since reading meant so much to me and this dream of once writing something myself grew so strong over the years, it was terrifying to actually start because I was in terror of finding that the only thing I would achieve would be showing that the dream was beyond my reach because the thing I wrote would not be good. So I postponed it and procrastinated for years and years, and I was a journalist for 13 years and had a stylistic outlet that way. And I had this idea and it took me so long, and I don't have a mind designed to sort of make a whole story, so I would just think about the first two or three chapters over and over and over for many years until I finally managed to start writing it.
And that all came together for you to do with tennis.
Yes. In the year 2012, I was sent to Dubai to do an interview with Roger Federer, who had just become the ambassador for Moët et Chandon, the champagne. So I probably pronounced it way worse than you pronounced my last name. But I was sent there and I needed something to read. And I downloaded onto my iPad a book called Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell, which I absurdly now share a publisher. And that book really blew me away. Any reader listening surely recognizes the fact that it's more difficult. As you grow older, it's more difficult to have these really strong reading experiences because you've read so much and you get picky. But he has written this book like a palindrome. He changes perspective, I think, 5 or 6 times, and then he goes back and forth in time, and it makes you want to read it faster. And he surprises you at every turn. And amazingly, it turns out that it's not form over function. He actually makes a point by doing that. And I remember being invited to party with Roger Federer that same night and chose to stay in my hotel room instead and finish Cloud Atlas. And that is the case. The structure of my book owes a lot to that book.
Well, let's talk about the structure. How is this book laid out?
Well, I'm part of a generation raised by Quentin Tarantino, so a sort of reverse chronology is not very exotic to me and seemed natural, but it starts out divided into 4 seasons. So it starts out in the autumn of 1793, where we start following an investigation, and then it goes to summer, and then spring, and finally winter, where we sort of pick up the investigation again.
And it's done in a variety of different forms. So, for instance, the second section is all letters.
The epistolary novel, I've been taught. Yes, there's a young apprentice surgeon, 16 years of age, who comes to Stockholm to pursue his fortune. And he is telling his story by writing letters to his sister.
Tell us about the Swedish at that time, in 1793.
Well, in 1792, the year before, the king, Gustav III, was assassinated. And that was the crescendo of a very useless war that he declared on Russia, which Sweden formally won, but we didn't sort of gain anything from it. It ruined the realm. and things got so bad that the only money left belonged to the nobility, and the king was
Your family, in fact.
My family was dirt poor at the time, so we didn't even have any money for him to take. But he wanted to sort of drain the nobility and court the budding middle class, which he was very much afraid of because of what was happening in France at the time. The middle classes sort of rebelled and the French Revolution came about. But the nobility, of course, they were the ones he should have been afraid of because they had him assassinated. So the crown prince was not of age, so there's a period of 5 years that is not very well known in Swedish history between the death of Gustav III and the sort of rise to the throne of Gustav IV, where there was a regency, an interim government, and there was a lot of chaos and a power vacuum, and I thought that was a really fertile ground to start.
And was there much research material available? And as you say, not a time that's particularly well known.
Well, the time in general, and I mean, Gustav III is one of the most well-remembered kings of Swedish history, and he's mostly remembered as a patron of the arts, and his reign was for a long time considered sort of a cultural golden age, and I have a rather a different view on that. But this whole age is very well-researched. I could have easily spent the rest of my life reading all this time, because very much has been written. So luckily for me, there was a lot of source material.
Mm. And of course, you bring this all together beautifully through the depiction of your characters, as you were saying about Umberto Eco. As long as you have strong characters, you can forgive a writer anything. Tell us about your characters. There are four principal people.
Yes, there is a man called Mikkel Kardell. He's a veteran of the Swedish-Russian War, where he had the misfortune to lose his left arm. And he's sort of making a living as part of a vice squad, if you will. This was a usual thing, that crippled war veterans were sort of employed to round up prostitutes and such, which was a big problem in Stockholm at this time. And he's the one who finds a maimed body at the start of this novel. And he pairs up with a man called Cecil Winge, who is charged by the Stockholm police chamber to investigate this supposed murder. Winge is very much a man of the Enlightenment, and he's also dying of consumption, which puts a ticking clock on the whole thing. But he realizes that this may be a worthwhile last thing for him to do in life. Then we meet Christopher Blix, who is, as I mentioned before, a 16-year-old surgeon's apprentice who comes to Stockholm in hope of making something of himself. And then there is Anna Stina, who is a young girl who loses her mother, her only parent, and all of a sudden finds herself defenseless. She has neither employer nor parents, and as such, when she's accused of prostitution, there is no one to speak for her. So she gets sent to the workhouse, which was essentially, I mean, state-endorsed slavery for the poor.
Now, I know that this book took you 8 drafts.
Yes.
Did the characters change much between 1 and 8?
Yes, they did. In particular, Winge and Kardell, they leaned a bit heavily on the Sherlock-Watson duality, which is, there's a reason that that is such a convention to this literature, because you have two characters. They're different and they complete each other and they can reason about what's going on to the benefit of the reader. And since they have so much to do, it's not as easy as a writer to also give them air to breathe and develop their personalities, while my secondary characters, they don't have a fixed task in the novel, so they fleshed out very easily because they could just be themselves. So that was for sure one thing that happened a lot. I had to make them more persons in their own right, and then plundering old Arthur Conan Doyle.
I'm really interested in your route to publication, how you go from this book, which has been sitting around in your brain for years and years and years, to really being the biggest book to come out of your country, really since Stieg Larsson. So tell us about that. Was getting published relatively easy?
No. The other way around. And in retrospect, I can see how that benefited me. Nobody wanted it. And naive as I am, I finished it and I only sent it out to the 3 biggest publishing houses in Sweden because I thought it would be embarrassing for me if more than one of them accepted it. And in fact, of course, none of them did. But as I got more and more rejected by different publishing houses, they would sort of do me the favor of submitting a small review of the book. Somebody had actually read the whole thing, and they give you the critique, which is actually a big favor, even if they reject your work. And there was a lot of consensus in the critique that I got, so that really made me read my own work with new eyes, and I saw the merit of what they were saying. And I thought to myself, wow, nice, I get to sort of revisit. I mean, I love these characters, but what will happen if we alter their personalities or if something different happens? And you would do that and there would be a ripple effect through the whole novel. And in the end, endings that I had figured out from the start no longer worked. And I had to sort of search for new ideas. And then I would be surprised at finding those new ideas. And they would sort of not only fit in with all the pieces, they would actually enhance the whole thing. So it was actually a joyful process. And now as I'm working on a sequel to this book, my only hope is that I will have the time to rewrite that 8 times as well.
So the book comes out and then it just becomes this juggernaut. What was the tipping point?
Well, it came out and nothing much happened. I mean, it sold along trudgingly. And I remember calling my dad and saying, wow, it sold 1,000 copies. It's amazing. 1,000 people. It's a lot of people. And I think it sort of lived up to everybody's very low expectations. But then I got a phone call. And the way I've been told this story by the man who phoned me afterwards, because I was confused at the time and I don't really remember it as it happened, but he was the chairman of the Academy of Swedish Crime Writers. And that day he had first called a wonderful author called Camilla Grebe, who was awarded the best crime novel of the year for 2017. And she, who knew very well what this entailed, was exuberant about it. And then he called me to tell me that I had won the best debut crime novel of 2017. And there was just silence at the other end. And then I said, but I haven't written a crime novel. But apparently those guys really know what they're talking about. So apparently I have, and I've come to terms with that fact. But that award became the first point. And then there's another Swedish crime writer. He's a famous professor of criminology and also a big media personality who sort of at the end of the year in a TV show he has on Swedish public service television, he names his top 3 favorite crime novels of the year, and he named my book as number 1, and then things really started to happen. Mm. So it's really been, I've been at the end of a series of very fortunate events.
But I mean, it sort of wasn't always like that. You went off to Gothenburg Book Fair, for instance, and there was very little interest.
Yeah, actually, as a debutante, you're advised not to go to the Gothenburg Book Fair the year your debut novel comes out, because it will be such an anticlimax that your self-confidence may never recover. But I happened to share an office with another Swedish writer called Fredrik Backman, who's written a book called A Man Called Ove, who is, well, it makes my success look like a fart in space. But being a very good friend, he invited me to have a seminar with him at the Gothenburg Book Fair. And of course, the publishing house wanted to do some events around that as well. So I went and I was interviewed on stage by my editor. And there was one guy in the audience and he had crutches as well. So I thought he was mainly after the chair, actually. But I mean, it's good. It's a character building exercise. And while my editor was, I could feel that he sort of was internally questioning why we were even finishing with the interview. I thought, wow, let's win this guy over. Let's do a really good work. This one listener, it could be worse. And if we do a good job here, then things will only get better.
Did he buy the book?
It turned out he had read half the book and sort of gave me a pat on the shoulder and said, I think it's not bad.
Not bad is an understatement, judging by its response, not only in Sweden, but now everywhere else as well. What do you think makes a hit? I mean, the fact that it did so well domestically, but how do you then translate that into this international success that it now is?
your guess is as good as mine and probably better, actually. But I remember when I was first contacted by my literary agency and they said that they wanted to try to sell this book abroad. I didn't know what they were talking about. I was like, wow, I've written a novel about Swedish history. I don't really see the appeal for any other audience. So I gladly signed that contract thinking, you're welcome to 25% of zero.
That's a huge percentage. We need to talk about your agent. Carry on.
No, they're the best agents. And I mean, look at the job they've done. They're welcome to every penny of it and more. So they really made the success. They made an amazing job of it. But of course, I was very, very surprised when I think Germany were the first awarded. And I thought, wow, somebody's going to get fired over this. But it continued in that manner, and I was more surprised than anybody.
Why the different titles? It's The Wolf and the Watchman here in Britain.
I was actually surprised that so many countries chose to retain the original title, which is 1793, because it's a year, and of course, to a Swedish audience, the year 1793 will have way different connotations than for maybe in particular a French audience. And even the French chose to call it 1793. In spite that Victor Hugo, his last novel was called, not 1793, but 93. And for them, I mean, they must think, oh, this must be about the Reign of Terror, for sure. So it's actually only in the English-speaking markets that it's got another title, which I'm fine with. They asked for suggestions, and my suggestions were way worse than this one. So I really like this title.
Now, one of the negative sides of this, I think, a lot of people have said to you, it's so violent. And it's very, very bleak. And I wonder how, firstly, you react to that. And secondly, how you write violence in your very elegant way.
At first, I was surprised that it was perceived as so violent. Because I'm not really a big child of the Nordic noir. I haven't read extensively in that genre. Not to say anything bad about it, but it just didn't happen. My inspirations came from other places. My prejudice was that, really grisly murders was sort of par for the course for that genre. And that is something that I could do. And to some extent, I naturally gravitate to that for reasons I can't really explain. But I remember a Dutch woman coming up to me in Amsterdam when I was doing a book signing and saying, I was reading that part in your book where that guy cuts out that other guy's tongue and I was eating breakfast at the time and I kind of threw up a little in my mouth. And I said, oh, I'm really sorry. It wasn't my intention to ruin your breakfast. And she said, no, it's a compliment. It's one of the weirdest compliments I've ever got. But I don't want to be exploitative and I don't want to have violence and horror for its own ends. It's not the way I want to entertain people. But going back to the source material, trying to make concrete what a bad time this was and what stuff was really going on and how, I mean, the oppression of the poor and the relentless class society, you have to sort of make a scene where that becomes apparent to the reader, and this was the natural way of doing it.
So the violence, a kind of analogy of the unjust system.
That is for sure my intention, and I hope I did not go too far. But to be on the safe side, nobody should maybe be eating breakfast while they're reading a book.
So this success feels like something that's kind of happened to you.
That is the way I feel. And as wonderful as it is, I have mixed feelings about it because I met so many writers who went the exact opposite way. I mean, they put out a first book and it becomes sort of a moderate success. And then they build and build and build. And like after 5 books, they're selling a lot. And reality is telling them that they are getting better and better as a writer all the time. Reality will soon be telling me that I am getting worse and worse because the sequel to this, I mean, obviously it's not a book for everybody. I'm amazed that it's turned out to be a book for as many people as it has. But many of those people will have thought this is not for me and they will not pick up a sequel to it. So I'm trying to brace myself for disappointment. And I must try to tell myself that I'm sort of dieting down to the audience I actually deserve. So success on this scale is phenomenal, but it has really to do with a lot of other things than what I've written.
Well, I think it's also to do with the fact that it's a jolly good book. Nicholas, thanks so much for coming on to speak to us.
Thanks for having me.
Nicholas Natt-Uchtach, The Wolf and the Watchman, is out now. It's published by John Murray. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Georgia McDonough and Christy Evans. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.